This is Scripture Read Badly,
a podcast where two grown-up pastors' kids discuss the stories of the Bible in chronological order,
attempting to avoid heresy and generally having a good time.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Ryan.
Sit back and rejoice. Today's verse comes from Jonah, chapter 2, verse 3. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me, all your waves and your billows passed over me. This is a great example of a perfectly written emo song about how the sea and Jonah fell in love, but then the sea didn't want any more. This is Scripture Read Badly. I'm Jeremy.
And my name is Ryan. is Ryan, and today we are having one of our semi-regular episodes called Controversial Theology, or Contro Theo if you are the abreaving type.
I am. Yeah. I love to abreave.
So, yeah, abreaving is fun. Okay, so today, as the listener will already know, having read the title of the episode, it is about... it kind of follows the question, what if more of the Bible is allegorical than we think? Or, on the other side of things, how much of the Bible is allegorical? And kind of what are the consequences if it all is, or if some of it is, or if some of it isn't? Yep. So we'll kind of be coming in and out of different thought trails that we're going to start that sentence again. We're going to be coming and going surrounding that question, seeing how interesting it gets. And if it's not interesting, we'll do what I just did, which is start a new sentence. So, Jeremy,
just skip
over to
ahead.
You.
I think thought trails should be more of a thing we talk about. Like, ooh, look at this trail of thought. Oh, it's trail of thought.
Yeah.
It's already a thing. Unbelievable.
Thought
That's
trails.
Funny with learning a new language, how they... order things, like different languages order different words a different way, and then you have to like swap it around, like, oh, that's what it is. Anyway, so this came to me, this thought came up in my thinking and my thought trails. when you read through some of these books entitled almost, how do you read the Bible? What is the Bible? Why do we have the Bible? Right. And they open it up, a lot of them open it up with the thought of the Bible is a collection of books that are written in different styles and themes, and we have to read them certain ways. And so when you track through the different themes of the Bible, even the verse I badly quoted at the start, Jonah. Jonah is either a history reportage. And so a man who is a prophet speaking on behalf of God goes somewhere and says something. It's not poetic, it's not theology necessarily, it's not a letter, it's a story. Or it could be an allegory. And when you look at the allegory and the characters, they could produce different messages because of their interactions.
Yeah.
Similar with the Book of Job. The Book of Job is definitely a story. And if we looked at it as historical, we would have to think about God and the devil and humanity a certain way. But it could be allegorical, or it could be just a poem, and so it changes how we read it. And so when we look at the Bible, it's not all one thing. It changes. But then, how much of it is allegorical? Because I grew up in a thought trail, looking at the Bible, that the whole Bible was literal, and so you had to read it literally. So all of the Psalms weren't songs, they were literal. Job wasn't a poem, it was literal, and so you had to read it a certain way. So
Song of Songs, of course, has been debated throughout history, going all the way back to the early Jewish commentators, on whether or not it is an allegory describing Yahweh's relationship with his people, or whether it is strictly Solomon and this woman, and maybe a shepherd and someone else thrown in the mix as well. But it's been one that's been up. It's been debated for centuries.
Yep. Yeah, and It's interesting when we look at the commentaries that come out of the different time periods and what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we come to our time period, what has influenced how we see. And so I was reading this book about the violent portraits of God in the Old Testament, and there are huge amounts of commentaries on them up until the 4th century. But then when Constantine created Christianity as the state religion, it became empire. It started taking on the language of empire. And so when you think of violence and power from on top, empire is going to love that, because then empire can give its... like the Death Star. It's like, well, in the Bible it says God did it and we're following God, so we're going to wield power as well. But when you looked at the commentaries and even the language of Jesus himself before empire came into the mix, it was never that way. Like, the Christian religion was from bottom. Like, it was dying to start this revolution. And so it's interesting, too, how we read the Bible because of our current thought trails throughout culture. And do we take that as fact, or do we go back? And then how far back do you go? And how back can you go for the commentaries of these different things? And so then the other big thought that I've had recently is none of it allegorical, but God set up these world events so that he could make it sort of allegorical for the future, like the flood.
Okay. Yeah.
That makes sense, right? Like,
I understand that.
The flood was a thing, like, let's say it was a real thing, and I honestly do think it's a real thing that happened, but God set up these things and interacted with humanity in such a way so that he could use it as allegory later. Or is it that future theologians have just reinterpreted these world events to use as an allegory? And so we look at the flood and that was a terrible time, but it was needed, and we're going to use it to explain what baptism is.
Right.
So that's the intro.
So let's get into it a bit. So I think for the sake of this discussion, we need to take a few different stances, and they will be things like, first of all, what if the creation story is an allegory or is poetry as opposed to literally happening, and then discuss how that affects theology, whether it does, or how that affects the interpretation of the rest of the Bible, and then kind of go through some of the different books or the different events that have been outlined in the Bible and see how they may be affected by this concept. So, Jeremy, what if creation was just an allegory and it didn't really happen that way, but it's in the Bible to teach us a lesson?
And I think we almost perfectly covered this when we were going through Genesis, where both of us came to the conclusion that I don't care. Like, I don't think it matters to theology if it was real or not. And some people would argue that it does affect if the world is 6,000 years old, then that interacts or influences how we see scientific studies like archaeology, who keep thinking that things are billions of years old. Well, how is something billions of years old if the planet is 6,000 years? And I think that gets in the way of a lot of realities. If, like, I think we all know what my beliefs are, but if the world is 6,000 years and these people are saying that it's more than 6,000 years, then they're lying and we shouldn't listen to them because they're not helpful. But if these dating systems are reliable and lots of people are pointing at the same dates, then maybe our dating of the Bible is wrong, because God never says in the Bible that it is 6,000 years old. That's just something we came up with somewhere. And so, But even if it is 6,000 and we don't trust archaeologists anymore, that doesn't change the fact that God created humans, God created humans to create life, God created humans to interact with him intimately like they were in the garden. Some of our decisions mean that we miss the mark and we destroy relationships, but God still wants us enough that he sent Jesus to die on a cross, right? So if it is a real story, that's crazy. Like, if it is real, the idea that there were only two people on the planet and they created people until there were 7 billion people on the planet, genetically and stuff like that, makes no sense. Like, where did all the other babies come from?
Right.
But
where did Cain's wife come from?
Exactly. Where do all the extra babies come from and all the extra people that they could have babies with without them coming out like Tasmanians? Ho, 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 sick burn on Tasmanians. That came out of nowhere. I love Tasmanians.
I've told you before that I was born in Tassie, didn't I? Haven't I?
I know. And you came out fine.
All right. Thanks. to non-Tasmanian parents, so I can still have a go at native Tasmanians, I guess.
Oh, true, you can.
Yeah, okay, so you're right. I feel like the young... that's it. That's all, folks. I feel like the dating system and the getting hung up on that type of thing surrounding the creation story is a huge stumbling block when it shouldn't be.
Yep.
And it causes, like you said, breakdown in relationships, or causes people to not trust smart people, or a whole bunch of other things, when we've just gone by the biblical timeline and tried to trace it back and see how long it would be between the birth of Jesus and the creation of Adam, and then that's roughly 4,000 years or something, according to the lineage that's outlined in the Bible. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that. And I agree with your stance surrounding the Genesis narrative that it doesn't really matter whether it was a literal creation account or not. What matters is what we learn from it, which is that God was intricately involved in every aspect of creation and sees everything that he created as good. Yep. And what is bad in the world is the result of good things becoming twisted, and they were not God's doing at all, and that man's decision to pursue knowledge of good and evil and know what is right and wrong was the reason that wrong came into the world in the first place. Yep. So whether that was genetically, whether that was through evolution, whatever the case, what we learn from the creation narrative is that God loves the world and God created the world, and we have a responsibility to steward the world in a way that honors him and furthers his goodness perpetuating throughout the world. So, okay, so we can tick that one off. Whether or not creation is allegorical or poetic, we have already covered that, and it doesn't matter.
But Jeremy ultimately believes that it's allegorical.
Right. Yeah, that's fine. And I think it is potentially. Yeah, I'm definitely undecided. Okay, so moving on to the next thing. Let's talk about the flood. So you said before that the flood could potentially be an allegory for baptism. Or for the fact... Yeah, and baptism is an allegory for, or at least a representation of God washing away sins of people and allowing them to emerge from the waters clean and new. With baptism being a symbol of the resurrection. Dying to your sins, being raised to life in Christ. So if the flood was an allegory, how would that affect your theology?
Well, I think if it's not an allegory, it can affect us by thinking that God is violent and he kills lots of people for no apparent reason.
Okay.
And when you look at, if it is a real story, humanity had become so destructive to itself that there was no way that they would end up living further than the next few generations. So God buried them and resurrected them in, I was about to say Moses, Noah and his family who restarted. And again, where do the extra babies come from? There's not enough babies to have 7 billion people come from them. So then when it says it was a flood across all of the earth, was it really the whole earth? Or was it just parts of the earth?
Yeah.
And then after they were resurrected, in quotation marks, did God just place more people on the planet for them to make babies from? And there's where the allegory is.
Ah, okay. Got it.
And I think this also comes back to the fact that the Bible isn't a history book. It just shows humans' interaction with God, and it doesn't show everything that happened. It just showed the main parts that God wanted or at least influenced to happen and to be written down, or not even to be written down, just be told the most.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, just because there was a flood,
not everything that God has done in the world has been recorded in the Bible.
Yeah, definitely. Throughout
history. It's just important things.
Yeah, or it's just certain things to point to other certain things. And that's why, why couldn't it be allegorical if it wasn't meant to be a history book, it's just meant to be God pointing to what he needs us to know.
Yep.
So, and that's the other thing, that if we look at the Bible as a history book and as a complete history book, then when we get to the Exodus, and for some reason we've all been convinced that the Israelites built the pyramids, but they definitely didn't, and history points to that. Just because the Bible doesn't line up with history that we have doesn't mean it's false. It just means that it's not a history book and it's telling stories that history may not have picked up.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you, I think I was raised to believe that this was all, it was all literal. And I don't know whether or not there was a spoken pressure or not, but there was some kind of pressure to believe that every single word written in the Bible was 100% accurate.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want to cross over into the inerrancy or the infallibility discussion.
They're just two different discussions.
Yeah, they are discussions for other times. But as far as it goes, historically, people's perceptions of particular dates and things have changed throughout history based on dating systems as well as different events that have happened too. So going back through history now in the modern day is harder to pinpoint exact moments. Like with the Exodus itself, there is debate about whether or not it happened in whatever year BC or the other year BC, and they're different by a few hundred years, and that changes the narrative that Genesis tells, that they're in exile for, or they were enslaved for 400 years. So again, I feel like as I am growing older, as I'm developing my own thoughts and ideas about my worldview, I suppose, and no longer really leaning heavily on that which I was brought up with, I feel like I am understanding that it doesn't matter as much as I used to think it did, whether or not things are allegorical. So with the flood, I don't mind. Either way, it tells a compelling story about God saving people in the midst of sin and choosing to reward righteousness. And you can, it's a great moral lesson, but at the same time, if it did happen, then that is the mercy of God coming through as well. Yep. I think in a way that it, so we can talk about the violence of God, because that was kind of the whole premise that you were bringing to the discussion initially, when you first brought up the idea to me, with the violence of God in the Old Testament, whether that is allegorical or whether it's literal and it did happen that way. And if it did happen, then what's our view versus if it didn't? Now, yep. I want to put forth the stance that if the flood did happen, it was not the violence of God against humanity so much as it was the righteous wrath of God against sin, which results in death for sin that causes death. And it happened that maybe in the providence of God, he saw that Noah was the only one that would respond in this way if they were saved, or if other people were saved, then humanity would not have been, and ultimately would have spiraled back to where it was. So I would like to say that the flood, even though it was violent and many, many people died, I feel like it was an act of mercy so that humanity would continue how it was supposed to. And
yep.
In many instances throughout the Bible, like with the plagues, that resulted in, I'm sure, the death of countless people. And that is, it's a terrible tragedy, but at the same time, it is a story of mercy. But I don't know whether or not that is just how it's been spun in the Bible.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are historical accounts in Egypt of the plagues that ravished the lands or whatever, and whether or not that's actually an event that they think back to and see as an horrific moment in their history. What do you think about that? Do you think that's something that may be seen as spun in the favor of the Jews?
Is that the finish of your sentence?
I'm going to start that one again. So, do you think that the fact that this Bible was written from the perspective of the Jews was not only written to write them favorably, but also to diminish the value of other people groups? And does that affect theology?
I think it can affect theology very much if we don't read it thinking that it was written by Jews in the time it was. Because, okay. And when you say favorably, some of the time I think it's written favorably in the theater and the dramatic, like all of us were killed and the whole world was against us and everyone was evil, like that sort of thing. But then we just finished the Book of Judges, and the Book of Judges does not paint the Israelites in a good light.
Absolutely not.
It paints them as a very hypocritical, up and down with their faithfulness kind of crew.
Self-destructive, yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because history is written by the victors. And so you think, if this is a Jewish book written to Jews to, like, promote their awesomeness, I would have written it heaps differently.
Right.
And so I think it's the tension of both. If you're maybe surrounded
on the Book of Jonah.
Or heaps of different books. I would have just included the Book of Acts and maybe the Book of
Esther?
Genesis. Oh, and Esther, the rescue one.
That was a fairly positive book.
And then kick out most of the kings. I would just write about like three of the kings. But if you're writing
the three kings.
I'd include the three kings.
Okay, yeah.
But if you're writing a book in the midst of war, and in the midst of a war that you're not necessarily winning,
and have don't necessarily have a promise of winning.
No. You would write it in certain ways. And if you've been not imprisoned, but enslaved, that's the word. If you've been enslaved by an empire for a long time and you miraculously leave that kingdom, you're going to write that in certain ways. And so I think that affects our theology a lot if we don't think about who's writing it, where they're writing it, what kind of environments they're writing it, especially if we're just going to pull quotes and force those quotes on other people. Which is, once I heard this, you know the show Q&A? There's this show in Australia called Q&A, and they usually get two politicians and two communicators and then like one or two randoms to answer questions from the audience. And they were talking about same-sex marriage and there was a conservative, like Christian politician on the panel, and they asked him something about the Bible, and he opened up by saying, well, the Bible isn't a book for kids. I was like, whoa, yeah. Because the concept is, a lot of the Bible, you need to know a lot of stuff to get it. Like, you can't just open up its pages at any spot and understand exactly what God was meaning. And that's why I think the whole allegorical thing could be true, because you have to sift through what was actually happening, what God was communicating to them, and what's God communicating to us, because it's not the same, and it could easily be allegorical.
Right, and, okay, so...
In bits, not entirely.
Right, and as I think with all stories, I think there's a saying that goes something like, if you're not... you look at history to make decisions in the present that affect the future. So you learn lessons from the past. You try not to make the same mistakes as those that came before. And sometimes that happens anyway. Sometimes even though you try and do the opposite of what a certain political stance or whatever it was that came before you did, you still end up going that way. But I think when you look at the Bible, as I think many English teachers would be encouraging people to do, like with any novel, right? You read the facts. Like I had to read 1984 in high school. So that's a dystopian novel set in England. And it's about
written by
crime,
genius,
and he was a smart man. It was an interesting story that was very creepy and didn't end in a very nice way, but it was fascinating. And so with studying that text, I had to, and I got through that book, didn't get through one of the other books that I had to do for English because I'm a slow reader, but I still managed to get 80%, which is what I got for all my grades and everything, no matter how much I like the subject. And so for 1984, I had to answer questions such as what events took place in order for X, Y, and Z to happen in the book. And then I had to go back and do an answer based on facts. And then there were questions like, what was the moral leaning of this certain character in this situation, and how did that influence their decisions for the rest of the book? And so questions like that got me to think about the simple facts that are outlined in this story in a different kind of way, and to learn something from the characters. And I think as a result, I got through the book not just thinking that was a very creepy story with a strange and kind of eerie through plot line. Instead, I got to the end and thought, yeah, the story was creepy and I didn't like it, but there were moments in there that I thought were absolutely fascinating, raised some great moral questions.
Yeah.
And as a result, I've been able to think about those moral questions and make decisions in my life based on the outcome of my decision. So with the Bible, like with reading 1984 in high school, if there is a passage like, say, the genocide of the Canaanites as Israel came across the Jordan in the book of Joshua, and the start of the book of Judges, we have the opportunity to not just read it as a story and say, this is what the Israelites did. They killed these people and they let these people live and they made a treaty with these people which came around to bite them in the butt. And you get to the end and think, okay, that was a story. These are the facts. That's it. Instead, you read it, you get the facts, and then you think, what can I learn from this? How can I apply moral lessons from within this text to my life? Like with anything that you read, okay?
Yep.
So then, I think with that in mind, it doesn't necessarily... There are some things in the Bible, which we'll get to, which are crucial for them to be actual historical things that happened. But there are other things that are less so. If they happened, that's great because it shows that that's what led to Jesus. But if they didn't happen necessarily how they're outlined in the Bible, that doesn't happen as long as Jesus was there, right?
Yeah.
So we're still, people still read and interpret the Bible, the Old Testament, in an allegorical way, whether or not they choose to read the facts as 100% true or not.
Yep.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right.
Jesus!
So, do you think Jesus is the only point in the Bible that must be non-allegorical?
But ultimately, Jesus is an allegory slash real life representation of God. So does that mean he is also allegory, but instead of using poetry, God uses a human body?
Well, kind of, but if you think about anyone in the world that you have met who has an interesting life story. And okay, so I don't know why, but I was just thinking about Frank Abagnale Jr. He is the guy from Catch Me If You Can, portrayed by Leonardo DiCaprio in the Tom Hanks movie Spielberg from a decade ago or whatever.
I'm Googling it.
So, okay, so he's a guy that lived many, many different lives and professions, but as a bit of a con man swindler. So he never received a pilot's license, but he lived as a pilot for X number of years before getting found out and then going on to a different fake profession as a lawyer or a doctor, like different things like this. Eventually, people started realizing that this guy isn't who he claims to be. Okay, and then eventually he went on to not just be a consultant for a whole bunch of different agencies, but he became famous for it. He wrote a book. He had a movie produced about him. He is a speaker, a motivational speaker at different events. And I'm sure he's done a TED Talk. Everyone's done a TED Talk. Except us.
TED Talk!
Not yet.
We'll do one in like 20 years.
That's right. How to Read the Bible Badly. That's the name of our podcast, isn't it?
That is definitely what we called it.
So with his life story, I got to the end of hearing about it and watching the movie and reading about it. And I thought, there are things that I can learn from this guy. Not how to con people, because that's bad. But how to... there were different things that he learned, situations that he responded to in certain ways that were good or seemed to be... And again, I'm not saying that it was any of the crimes he did, but his attitude in a lot of situations was quite positive. And so hearing his story, I thought, wow, I could learn a thing or two from this guy. Maybe when I'm faced with this type of situation, I'll act differently. And it's like that when you hear any person tell their life story or their testimony.
Yep.
So you get to the end of it, you hear their story, and you think, that was a great story. Even if it wasn't the person themselves telling it to you, you hear that story and apply it allegorically, essentially, to your life. So whether or not Jesus can be portrayed as an allegory is irrelevant, because everybody can be.
Does that make sense? Okay, yep. But your original question is, should we believe that the reporting of Jesus is true?
Right, okay.
And I think you can, because there's so much historical evidence.
Hmm.
And I think there's a lot more historical evidence than the Exodus, let's say.
Sure.
Or Jonah, or Job, or all of these ones.
Yep.
And they're closer in proofing, and they're closer in time to us, so it's easier to be like, bam, 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 definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point of Jesus is that he was real, and he was the climax or the crux of existence.
Yep.
And so all of the allegories or historical fact in the Old Testament is there to point to Jesus.
Yep.
Which I think you said just before.
Yep. It's setting up the climax of the whole story. Yep.
Exactly.
Okay, so... Yes, there is a lot more historical evidence that Jesus existed and especially that his followers existed and had influence. My question for you then is, if the account of Jesus is not allegorical, if that actually happened, do you think that the facts would have been as important to the early church as, say, they are now in the information age, or during the Age of Reason, or other times throughout history where having proven facts became essential, as opposed to, say, the like during the eras where free thought was more encouraged and embracing of different kinds of mysticism and that type of thing.
Ooh, mysticism. Yeah. I think because it was before the printing age and it was even before a lot of things were written down.
Yep.
The facts probably weren't super important, but there were just so many of them that you couldn't get away from it.
Yeah.
And then it started being written down and shared. Okay. And so I think at first the oral history of Jesus and the start of the church was spread quite openly and bloody bloody by a lot of people. But it wouldn't have been like, and at 12 o'clock on Sunday, Jesus said these 2,500 words, and I'm quoting it verbatim.
Okay, but do you think that would have been important to them? Or do you think the fact that there were signs and wonders and other things happening and they could see the proof in the lives of the people telling the story was enough for them?
Because yeah, I feel that like, one.
Okay. Because I feel like today there is a certain resistance to blind belief.
Yeah.
But I will say,
but for them it wasn't blind belief because they had all of their Jewish history to go off as well.
Yeah, and they also had eyewitness accounts and everything like that. Okay, but I have seen these days, I have met people who were openly skeptical of everything to do with Christianity. And then at some point, they just had a moment where the facts or the amount of historical evidence for things didn't matter as much to them, and suddenly their life was changed. And the goodness and the love of God was all that mattered, and they knew that to be true, and that was enough. And they could fill in the gaps after that, kind of having the big picture. But there's kind of this pressure that I think a lot of us feel around evangelism to be able to present facts to people and let that change their mind, as opposed to presenting love and presenting actions to people and allowing that to change them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But I think that's also the difference between science and faith. Like, science is something we can prove and faith is something we can't. We just trust.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we get those two mixed up.
Hmm.
And sometimes it's the opposite too, like, oh, we don't need proof that gravity exists, we just blindly believe. And so I think people want at least a bit of proof. Wow, my brain just stopped. But, like, you talk to some of these people who need proof, and you wonder at what level it was until they tipped over to be like, all right, I don't need the rest, like you just said. And then you meet these other people who just need to see a healing or feel something, and then they're like, yep, I'm in. I don't need anything else. And I feel like Jesus and the apostles dealt with all of those kinds of people in the biblical narrative.
Yeah. Well, Lee Strobel famously
exactly.
wrote The Case for Christ, and he was one of those people that was very much it was a fact-based conversion, but I think with him the facts led him to the cross, and then the cross is kind of where his heart broke.
Yeah.
So whether or not people have a distinct change of heart towards things may not necessarily be an indication that they have had... it may not necessarily be an indication of a conversion, right? It may be people that say, I've read up on it, I've heard people's accounts, sounds good, I haven't had a big crying, speaking in tongues moment.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But I guess I'm going to believe anyway. And I think C.S. Lewis was, he said that he was a reluctant convert, or the most reluctant convert or something, because he had kind of one of those accounts where it was a mixture of seeing demonstrations of people's love and charity, and also understanding and knowing the facts and the context in the Bible. And that kind of, that led him to just decide that it was for him. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
So facts or feelings, I think they are both valid, but you can't have just feelings. You need to have at least a couple of facts, like God created the world, he loves you, Jesus came, you're saved.
Yep. And boom.
And boom. Otherwise, it's just open mysticism, and it's not grounded in anything, and you'll just be blown away in the wind that comes in the evening.
Ooh, or something. Evening wind.
Evening winds. I get them from
That's
time
like when
to
you've
time.
Eaten too many beans, right?
Exactly.
Oh, evening wind.
Yeah. Okay, Jeremy, so if we had to put an exact figure on it, how much of the Bible do you think is allegorical?
100%.
Oh, great.
Maybe, ooh, a figure of it. I wouldn't be uncomfortable if it was 70%.
Okay.
I would probably think most people think it's 5%.
Sure.
And I disagree with that figure.
Okay, but you're willing to go up as far as 70% as long as the remaining 30 has to do with Jesus?
All of it has to do with Jesus.
Okay, yep. I guess so.
Ooh, okay. Because most of the New Testament is theology or history.
Hmm.
So maybe the New Testament is like 10% allegory. Okay. And then the Old Testament would be... Well, and most of the prophetic books would be largely reporting of allegory used to communicate things.
True. And also Jesus told parables, so...
Yep. So, okay. Ooh, 70%. Maybe I'm back up to 70%.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
you convinced me.
I like that. I don't think I could quite go as high as 70. I mean, I think, like you, I would be comfortable.
Yeah.
Up to 70%. I think if it was more than that, then you start infringing upon certain events that are important to lead up to Jesus. Because Jesus had to fulfill some prophecies. Actually, a lot of prophecies in order to be considered the Son of Man, and then also the Son of God.
Yep.
I think conservatively, I think I would say 5% is allegory. If you're taking out the the prophetic books and the parables that Jesus told, but I think I would be more likely to land around 15%.
Okay.
Being allegory, but like I said before, I don't think it necessarily matters until you get up to a certain point.
Okay, so the Book of Psalms, you would say that is what?
Part of it is, so it's like an artistic interpretation of historical events or feelings.
Okay.
Of the composers, and as songwriters, you and I understand that. Like, if you look back at your life, there were certain things that happened that led you to write a certain song, and that kind of becomes a moment in your history.
Yep.
And if somebody were to say the name of a particular song that I'd written, I would immediately think not just to that song, but also to what led me to write that.
Yep.
So a lot of the Psalms are either to do with encounters with God or encounters with people that lead them to God. So, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how that works into allegory or not, because it's
just straight up poetry.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably just poetry, but it has some kind of historical context. Not sure.
Yeah.
But what do you think out there, listener? Do you have any ideas about what parts of the Bible could be allegorical? Any that we haven't talked about today? Like, what haven't we talked about? Like, do you think...
lamb?
Do you think a lamb?
Or the kings?
Yeah,
because
true, the three kings.
Mm-hmm. Is there... Yeah, because the three kings, some people say they're from three different continents of the world at the time.
Yep.
So is that allegory for the nations coming to bow down to Jesus? And I think it is. Mm. But then I just thought, can there be a tension between when these events actually happened, them being real, and now that we're not in those times, we're looking back, for us, they're allegorical, and can they be both? But also the kings of, like, the book of Kings, because you have sometimes one chapter for 40 years of life, is that detailed enough to be historical? Because it paints that person in a very specific light, that 16 chapters on 40 years would paint less or more.
Right. We would like to hear your response, listener.
Yeah.
If you have anything that you've been wrestling with, whether it's the creation narrative itself, or whether it's the Exodus, or whether it's I don't know, anything throughout the Bible, whether or not the Israelites came in and actually killed a lot of people to get the land, or whether the land was largely vacant. And that was just a story that was told to symbolize them coming into their own. Do you think the violence of God, or the things that he instructs the Israelites to do on his behalf in the Old Testament, are allegorical, or whether they actually happened? We would like to know. This is a discussion that, as you've heard, we aren't 100% certain on, so we want your input. And we think it could spark some really interesting discussion. So you can find us on social media. It's all in the description of this episode. And we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we should. I mean, we would. And we could.
Yeah. So with all that said, I'm going to give some advice, and then Jeremy's going to give the blessing. My advice is, if somebody tells you their life story, you should do absolutely everything that they did and more. Whether it's Frank Abagnale Jr. and you just go out there and be a con artist, do it better than him, because he was pretty good, but you get your little con shoes on and you'll be good, I'm sure, as well. And yeah, his ceiling is your floor, is what we say here. That's it.
And here we mean the internet.
Yes.
And may all of your sons and all of your daughters find appropriate partners to make their own sons and daughters, to populate the world as Jesus told us to. Amen. Aww.